The title of our lesson is The Plan and Power of God. I'm going to cover two chapters. You're going to feel like it's an adult Sunday school because that's what they do all the time. We are going to fly by, so we're not going to be able to wade through some of the details, but you can remember the words plan and power and God. The plan and power of God. How do you find that people treat God? On your team, in your neighborhood, at school, in your class, how do people treat God?
It's kind of like the man upstairs.
Yeah, you hear that phrase. That's in songs a lot, right? And it's like, oh, you just ruined that song. Like the man upstairs. Like, he's just one of us, but he just happens to be in heaven. All right? How else do people treat God? That'd be a very casual approach. Andrew? Overall, lack of respect. Yeah. What else? Hudson. Man, that's a good way to put it. Like a vending machine. And that's what's going to happen in our passage today, right? We only pray to God when we want something. We only do something because we want something out of him. Sam, is that what you're going to say? Yeah, they mock him. All right. Julio? Lack of care. All right, people try to ignore God. They try to write them out of their life and write them out of their existence. I mean, we know that God created everything, and therefore we are accountable to God. He is the authority. What he says goes. And I hope that you have a high view of God and you have a high view of his word, but unfortunately, a lot of people don't. God is a good luck charm. All right, I've heard him called a lucky rabbit's foot. You guys don't have those things anymore, right? That was a weird thing back in the day where people like really, I think it was a literal rabbit's foot that was cut off and dried and dyed, and it was supposed to be like a lucky thing, all right? Well, today the Israelites are going to use the Ark of the Covenant like it's a lucky rabbit's foot. And how do you think that worked out for them? It doesn't work out for them. God is to be feared, is to be respected, is to be honored, but the beauty of God, he is also to be enjoyed. He is to be loved, right? He is an authority figure, right? If you were to look at him, you would disintegrate, but at the same time, he calls us his children. We are friends of God. And it is a hard concept for us to comprehend at times. So obviously those that are unbelievers are going to get those things wrong. Why is today's passage in the Bible, all right? That's what I want you to think through as we go through this, all right? Every single word is important. Every single passage is important. But of all the things, because you know there's more that went on with the nation of Israel that we don't know that wasn't written down. It's like in the book of John. John said there are many more miracles and signs which are not recorded in this book. There's more things, but God, for whatever reason, chose to put this in our copy of his word. Why is that? Well, let's start with the theme of the book. Someone hit me up with the theme. Transition from judges to monarchy, okay? So this is a piece of that puzzle. 1 Samuel is teaching us how they went from a theocracy to a monarchy. And these events get us there. And we understand, right? The people of Israel started out as a what? Abraham. A family. They were a family, all right? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. From Jacob, you have the 12 tribes. So they're first and foremost a family, right? And so when it was just Abraham as the dad, the patriarch, how do you think things worked? Abraham said, and everyone else obeyed, okay? Well, that's one family. Did it get trickier when Jacob had 12 sons and those sons had sons of their own? That became harder, right? when they went down to Egypt because of the famine, they were still a family. But when they were in Egypt, they multiplied into the millions. And when they left Egypt, they were no longer a family. They were now a what? A nation. They were their own country. Who gets to lead? Did they have an election? Is it a democracy? Did they set up a judicial branch real quick or something like that and have a legislature? No. Who got to lead? Please tell me you know the answer. Awkward silence just makes the lesson go longer. Hudson? Okay, God? Moses, right? But why did Moses get to tell them what to do? Because God picked Moses. You see how it works. And so Moses led the people, and then after Moses led the people, Joshua led the people, all right? Why did Joshua get to lead the people? God told them, Joshua's up next. But then after Joshua, what happens? God, for a time, would kind of let the nation go and do its own thing. And did they choose God or did they choose sin? They chose sin. And when Joshua went into the land, they were to conquer and divide. They were to totally obliterate all of the pagan nations that were in there. But unfortunately, there were areas they did not conquer. There are areas that they did not root the people out. So there were times that those people started to rub off on them. You ever hung out with your friends and they talk a certain way? There's a stupid time where this word hot rod was a really cool word. He was like, "What's up, hot rod? I don't know, hot rod. What are you doing?" And everyone would talk like that because it just rubbed off. So Israel was living with these other nations. And they're like, "Oh yeah, it's cool to worship Yahweh. But why don't you worship this thing over here with me?" Well, yeah, okay, that sounds all right. And their heart would be pulled away, and judgment would come. And in the book of Judges, you have the cycles of disobedience and defeat. So then God would send someone, name a judge. Give me a judge, any judge, not Judge Judy. Give me a judge. Any judges? Gideon, all right. Come on, Cademan, you should have got that one. We got Gideon as a judge. Who else is a judge? Samson's a judge. We got any other judges? Deborah's a judge. Yeah, we have these judges. God would raise them up over time, and they would lead the people, and the people would obey, and the nation would have success. Well, we have reached the end of the period of the judges, where Eli is now the priest that's in charge. And it's going to go from Eli, who is not a good man, to Samuel, who is a godly man. But when Samuel gets old, who does he give authority to? Do you remember? Well, before that, before Saul, what do we tend to do sometimes? And it's not always the best idea. You're in charge, and so when you get old, you hand it over to your kids, okay? So Samuel's kids. And Samuel's kids were like Eli's kids, where everyone's like, "Whoa, we don't want them to rule over us. Give us a what? King, so that we may look like all the nations." Now, God's plan and path was them to always have a king. You knew that they were going to have a king. He even says it in Deuteronomy. He gave them rules and regulations for when they finally did have a king, but their heart wasn't right. Their motivation wasn't right. They didn't say, "Hey, God, give us a king so that we can follow him as he follows you." No. They said, "We want to look like everybody else." This whole judges model. But ultimately, God, it was a theocracy. Theo being God, God was in control, and they reject God, and they say, "We want a human ruler over us." But here we are in the plan and the path. When we get to chapter 4, we are not yet to the point where Eli has transferred power to Samuel, who Samuel will then transfer that power eventually to the first king, and his name is Saul. What have we already learned in our first three chapters? In 1 Samuel 1, we see Hannah. We see her faithfulness. We see the promise of a son. You know, Samuel, or she promised Samuel to live in the house of Eli and to serve there. We see her prayer in chapter 2. We see in chapter 2 that Eli's sons were worthless men. How would you like that? Of all things recorded about you in Scripture, the description is that you are worthless. They were actually abusing, and there was sexual immorality going on. All right, people were coming to worship God, and they were preying upon the people, and this was not a good situation. And Eli was kind of like out of sight, out of mind, and he just let his sons do the things that they were doing. You see in verse 22 of chapter 2, it says, Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Huh, are you kidding me? He said, why do you do such things? The evil things that I hear from all these people. No, my sons, for the report is not good, which I hear from the Lord's people. All right, no, it should have been, you die now. You're dead. That's God's law. That's what he would have wanted to happen. And they didn't follow, and he didn't do those things. What about chapter 3? What's going on in chapter 3? Chapter 3, verse 1, it says, the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days, and visions were infrequent. And we have God appearing to Samuel. And from this, okay, Eli now realizes, and Samuel realizes, that he is the one that is to take over after Eli. Look at verse 19 of chapter 3. Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. All Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as the prophet of the Lord. From, and you don't, geography, Dan to Beersheba. The whole country knew this. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. And that takes us to chapter 4. And I'm going to teach each chapter kind of separately, and then I'll wrap them up. Chapter 4, Israel is defeated. So if you're a note taker, the title is The Plan and Power of God. And then maybe your big point number one is simply, Israel is defeated. Israel is defeated. And if you haven't read the chapter recently, anyone want to take a stab at why Israel was defeated? You don't obey God, you lose. That's pretty simple, right? When it comes to this defeat, and so if I'm a note taker, I'm going to write defeat, and then I have 5 subpoints under the word defeat. The subpoints are the location, the opponent, the result, the million-dollar question, and their solution. And I know you didn't have time to write all that down, so I'll come back to it. We have the defeat, which is found in verses 1 through 4, and we're going to start with the location, the location. The word of Samuel came to all Israel, and now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer while the Philistines camped in Aphek. For us, that doesn't mean a whole lot, right? We don't remember those things. I don't have it up on the screen, but essentially, they're in the land. They go out. They're in these two separate places. B is the opponent, the Philistines. The Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. Have we seen the Philistines before? Yes. Do they get along? No. Do the Philistines go away anytime soon? No. Remember, David always fought who? The Philistines. Who was it that fought Saul at the end of 1 Samuel? The Philistines. These Philistine people. Why did they want to fight them? I don't know, maybe they were just upset, or they were angry or something like that, all right? They wanted their land, they wanted their stuff, they wanted to get back at them. C would be the result. We had the location, the opponent, the result. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. This should not be. God's plan for Israel was that they would love him, and they would serve him so that he would then protect them and he would give them victory. They were to live in such a way so that other nations would cower in fear when they heard about these Israelites. But these Israelites had walked away from God. The Philistines had heard about it and said, they're not superhuman anymore. We can take them down. And so 4,000. And when we went through the whole thing with Asahel and the beginning of this, the battle and stuff, and it was like 12 men died or something along those, it's like, wow, that's a terrible loss. 4,000. 4,000 died. D is the million-dollar question. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? What happened? You remember the whole thing with Joshua and Ai, spelled A-I? And they went to fight those people and they lost. Do you remember what the reason was why the people lost? Hudson? Achan took of the spoil when he shouldn't have. So when they came back and they go, why'd we lose? God told them it was Achan. All right, let's handle it. Now they're coming back. Why did we lose? Why did we lose? I want you to go to Deuteronomy 28. Remember, Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. Moses is about to be with the Lord, but he's reiterating these things to him once again. It says in verse 1 of Deuteronomy 28, now it shall be if you diligently obey the Lord your God. And let that be a lesson. It isn't half-heartedly. It isn't kind of sort of maybe. You know what it is when you are diligent with your homework, okay? You know what it looks like as opposed to when you're just trying to slide that 70 in, okay? Diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, not just the ones you like, not just the ones you think apply to you, all of his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. Okay, whoa, pause. Are they higher than the Philistines right now? No, they just got crushed. All these blessings will come upon you and will overtake you if you obey the Lord. Isn't that an awesome picture? The blessings, remember the turn of the king when the ghosts came to that battle and the green guys just overcame everything? His blessings will overcome you. Oh, I want that. Are there any blessings overcoming them in 1 Samuel 4? No. Verse 3, blessed shall you be in the city. Blessed shall you be in the country. Verse 4, blessed shall the offspring. Verse 5, blessed shall. Verse 6, blessed shall. Verse 7, the Lord shall cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They will come out against you one way and will flee before you seven ways. That is not what happened. Go down to verse 15. But it shall come about if you do not obey the Lord your God to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes with which I charge you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Verse 25, the Lord shall cause you to be defeated before your enemies. Bingo. You will go out one way against them, but you will flee seven ways before them. You will be an example of terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Your carcasses will be food to all. Birds of the sky and beasts of the earth, and there will be no one to frighten them away. The Lord will smite you with the boils of Egypt and with tumors, with the scab and with the itch from which you cannot be healed. You see, God has given us parents. And when it comes to our parents, there are things they tell us to do. And we can choose to diligently do them. And what happens with us and the parents? They're happy, right? Or sometimes they give you money or whatever it is. But then there are times that the parents give us something to do and we say, don't want to. Okay, well, what happens then? Well, it depends on how tired your parents are and how much they're, sometimes the belt comes out, sometimes you get grounded, sometimes whatever it is, okay? There are consequences, okay? God gave us the parents so that we would understand what it means to relate to Him. He commands us. We obey Him. And if we obey Him, we are walking in His grace and His love, and there's a blessing of that relationship. But if we choose not to, Israel here pictures us, okay? If you have not repented and placed your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, you're like one of these soldiers that walks up to the Philistines and is defeated. They have chosen not to obey God. The million-dollar question really isn't that complicated. Why did Samson have his eyes poked out and lose his strength? Was it because his hair was magical? Him telling Delilah the secret and the hair being gone was symbolic of his disobedience and God removing the power and the strength. With God, bruh. Without God, ugh. What about you? What about your life? How are you doing things? E would be their solution. Their solution. They clearly did not consult the Bible because of their solution. Let us take ourselves from Shiloh, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it, do you get that? It may come among us and deliver us from the power of the enemies. Do you remember what was in the Ark? Okay, the Ark was a box, golden box. And on top, it had a special lid and had these like symbolic angels on it. Do you remember what was inside of it? The Ten Commandments. That's pretty awesome, okay? Was there anything magical about the stones? No, but that's pretty cool. The original Ten Commandments were inside of this. What else was inside of it? Grady? Aaron's staff, all right? There was some special cool stuff that happened with Aaron's staff. Boom, that baby's in there. And lastly, what's the third thing that was in there? Manna. Remember God, how he gave them the delicious manna each day in the wilderness? Some of that manna was there. They looked at it and they said, here's our ticket. Let's take the ark with us. I'd like you to flip to Joshua 3 real quick. Okay? Flip to Joshua 3. This will help us understand their thought process. We'll understand their logic. Chapter 1, this is Israel crossing the Jordan, okay? Look at verse 6. Joshua spoke to the priests saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over ahead of the people. So they took the Ark of the Covenant and went ahead of the people. Now the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. You shall, moreover, command the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the edge of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord. Verse 11, behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of the earth is crossing over ahead of you into the Jordan. Verse 14, when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan, the priest carrying the Ark of the Jordan for the people. Verse 15, when those who carried the Ark came into the Jordan, the feet of the priest carrying the Ark were dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of the harvest. And the waters which were flowing from above stood in rows in one heap, a great distance at Adam, and the city beside it, and those which were flowing down toward the Sea of Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off, so the people crossed opposite Jericho. Why did God, we remember the Red Sea, right? Moses, the Red Sea, no alternative. They crossed on dry land. Well, when Moses left, anyone that said, wait a minute, I don't know if we should follow this Joshua guy. Well, God made sure it was shadow without a doubt They go to the Jordan River and whoosh, but it was the Ark of the Covenant, which was the symbol that went before them. Okay? So you kind of understand their logic in it, but they were using the ark like a lucky rabbit's foot. Just a trinket. So what happens? Go back to 1 Samuel 4. So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. We got some real winners here, don't we? Let's look at point two. And point two would be their second defeat. It didn't work. It didn't work. I just have two subpoints. One would be the pregame activities. All right, all the stuff before you get to the action. And then you have the postgame results. The pregame activity and the postgame results. Verse 5, as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout so that the earth resounded. Guys, the Ark, it's here. Woohoo! Let's go. Verse 6, when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, what does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean? Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. Wait. These pagan people connected the dots. And how did they react? The Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. Now, what are they missing here? Who has not actually come into the camp? God has not. They weren't scared of a box with handles. They were scared of God, but the ark was to represent the presence of God. And the Philistines understood this, but the Israelites didn't get it. They didn't get it. Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. And then someone stands up and says, you know what? Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight. It's the only option. Verse 10, the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated. Just a small comment. They were so sure, they were so pumped, they were so excited. Their faith was placed in the wrong thing. Every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000. 30,000. Some of you are in fantasy football leagues, and many of you don't care so much about winning at all. You just don't want to lose it all because you have some sort of stupid punishment built in, right? And the last thing you want is to have to do that milk jug mile or whatever it is you kids came up with, sitting at the front of church, whatever it might be. Nothing compares to this right here. They lost. And if they didn't die, the Philistines were going to come in and they were going to enslave them. Wow. It gets worse. The Ark of God was taken, but then it gets better. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. At least we're done with those bums. They should have been killed a long time ago. But the ark is gone. So that's the second defeat. Let's look at number three, the report. The report. With the report, we're going to A, look at Eli, and then B, we're going to look at Phinehas' wife. Verse 12, now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And when he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, eagerly watching, because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. That's a weird statement. I think Eli didn't want to be the priest that lost the ark. I think that was his main concern here. He would go down in infamy. I mean, this baby's been here since Moses, and he's the one that lost it? So the man came to tell it in the city, and all the city cried out. And when Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does this noise, the noise of this commotion mean?" Then the man hurriedly came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. The man said to Eli, "I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And he said, "How did things go, my son?" Then the one who brought the news replied, "Israel has fled before the Philistines." That's not good. "There's been a great slaughter among the people." That's not good. "Your two sons also are dead, and the ark of God has been taken." And when he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backward. So you think a dad would be like sad that his sons died? But he was like, so as it is. "But he fell off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was old and heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. I don't want to know how I'm going to die, okay? I'm assuming it's going to be in an airplane or someone dropping me from somewhere high. This is terrible. He was just a big old fat dude who fell over and broke his neck. This is symbolic of his life. He was a priest, guys. He was to be a bridge builder to God. He was supposed to say, "No, don't do that. Follow Yahweh." And 40 years wasted. Wasted. And now he's dead. That was his response. Verse 19, it says, "Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news," how would you like to be her, by the way? Married to that bum of a guy. "Was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was taken, that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman stood by and said to her, 'Do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son.' But she did not answer or pay attention. She called the boy Ichabod." Ichabod means no glory. "Saying, 'The glory has departed from Israel.'" And that boy would have that stigma for all of his life. Hey, why'd they name you Ichabod? Well, it was my dad that took the ark into battle and lost it. She did not answer or pay attention. She called the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." She said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken." She just gave up. Slavery to the Philistines would have been catastrophic. I mean, imagine being owned by pagan people with no morals. What would they do to you? What would they do to your children? What would they do to women? But the worst part of this was the ark was gone, and that God's name was defamed. God's name was defamed. Let's look at chapter 5, and I know you're getting worried here. Chapter 5 goes much faster than chapter 4. It kind of sets the tone. Chapter 5 is cooler. Good stuff happens in chapter 5, all right? Even though the Israelites were defeated, who was not defeated? God was not defeated. God wasn't up in heaven like, "Oh, man, can't, ugh." No, this was his path. This is his plan. We have three simple outline points for chapter 5. Number one is down goes Dagon. Down goes Dagon. Where did I get that outline point from? Where did I get that phrase from? Come on, people. Down goes. Apparently, you don't like boxing, which is okay because I think it's stupid too. The down goes Frazier. Down goes Frazier. Remember when George Foreman and the fight and whatever. Look at verse 1. "Now the Philistines took the ark of God and they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and they set him in his place again. I think you need to remember, all right, that Dagon is no god at all. He is wood or stone or silver or gold or whatever he is, all right? The ark is also not God, but the ark was representative of God's presence. And here they thought, our trophy, let's lay it at the feet of Dagon. Dagon, you won, because they associated their victory. Our gods must be real. Their god must be fake, or else they would have won. They would have beat us. Verse 4, but when they rose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold, and only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priest of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. Oh, you thought you beat Yahweh. You didn't beat Yahweh. Yahweh delivered up his people to you. And he let you take his ark so that he could have you bring the ark to show his power and his glory in your city. Outline point number two. Down goes the Ashdodites. And you know where we got the phrase down go? Moving on. Now the hand of the Lord was very heavy on the Ashdodites. And he ravaged them and he smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and Dagon our God. Oh, if he would just, oh, Dagon, poor Dagon, he's being oppressed. Dagon has no power. So what do? They sent and they gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they said, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. And Gath is like, really, bro? Why are you hating me on like that? We know what happened to you. Don't bring that over here. We don't want that. But they brought the ark of the Lord of the God of Israel around. Let's look at number three. There's a theme here. Down goes the Gathites and the Ekronites. Down goes the Gathites and the Ekronites. They brought the ark of the God of Israel around. And after they had brought it around, what do you know? The hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion. And he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. And as the ark of God came to Ekron, the Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought the ark of God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people. They sent, therefore, and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of the God of Israel. Let it return to its own place so that it will not kill us and our people. For there was deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. Went up to heaven. Now, the ark was brought to the battlefield. And at the battlefield, God could have smote the entire army of the Philistines with tumors and could have confused them, right? Why did he choose not to? Because this is an object lesson. An object lesson that we learn from today. That even though the wicked may appear to have victory, God ultimately is the winner is the winner. Have you ever looked at people and said, well, look, that guy gets the girl and this guy gets the money and, you know, he's such a jerk, but, you know, he gets this and those things and whatever it is. And there will come a day that that person will stand before the Lord and they'll give an account for their life. And God will punishment in that time if there are not consequences even on this earth. When we look at chapter 4 and we look at chapter 5, how are we going to conclude this? What do I learn? What should you learn? Well, number one, God will make good on his promises. God will make good on his promises. What promise am I talking about? Go back to Deuteronomy 28. Obey, blessing. Obey, victory. Disobey, curse. Disobey, defeat. All right? And so you see that living out here in the nation of Israel. But do you connect the dots to your own personal life? God has promised that every person apart from Christ will be thrown into the lake of fire for eternity. They will burn in perpetual torment in hell for eternity. He has promised that. Do you think when it comes time for it to be executed, he's going to go, nah, whatever. The only thing that will stay the hand of the executioner is the blood of Christ. It is the sacrifice that Jesus made in our place. So on one hand, he promises, guarantees that everyone who is apart from him will be punished. He also promises that everyone who comes to him will be forgiven. Will be forgiven. And our life is anew and it is secure. And he will love us and he will never leave us nor forsake us. He will hear our prayers. He will guide us in paths of righteousness. I mean, you go on and on. Any promise you can think of, God's going to make good on it. It cost God 4,000 Israelites to drive his point home. But he did it. Number two, God and his purposes cannot be defeated. God and his purposes cannot be defeated. So when it comes to the plan of God, what God has orchestrated, what God has promised, he's going to make good on it. When it comes to the power of God, he can make sure that anything he wants cannot be defeated. And if you are fighting him currently, you will lose. Are you more powerful than the Philistine army? You ever thought of that? I mean, we watch so many movies where people are like fighting and stuff and like, ah, oh, can I take that guy? Yeah, I think I can take that guy. You know, that one, I might let someone else take that guy. You can't take God. You can't run from God. You can't hide from God. Are you fighting him? And it could be, Christian, that there are things in your life that you know are wrong, that you know that you shouldn't be doing. Maybe there's things you're watching on your phone or there's music that you're listening to that you know is not glorifying. Maybe there's lies that you're spreading or there's slander or maybe you're not working as hard in your classes as you should be doing. And we think that we can sneak around and get away with those. The unbeliever is in constant battle with God. But there are times even as believers we can choose to do things our own way. And God does not love that. God sees that and he hates that. We need to bow down and submit to him. This is a wonderful and beautiful story, and don't let it be lost. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you that you are in control of all things. We thank you that you know our heart, that you know our thoughts, that you know our mind. I pray for these young men that they would learn from these lessons. There's a lot of examples of who not to be in these chapters. And I pray that they would be faithful like Samuel. Pray that they would read your word, study your word, and obey your word. And that they would love you and serve you in all things and all ways. It's in your son's name we pray. Amen.